We're talking this week about dispensationalism. And I'm not going to use that word a lot, but there are three main marks or characteristics of dispensationalism. And my goal has been to talk about all three of those. The first one we talked about during the Sunday school hour this morning. And that is that we understand the prophetic passages of Scripture in a literal sense. And by that, what we mean is that we think that the prophecies of Scripture that haven't been fulfilled yet ought to be interpreted in the same way as the prophecies that have been fulfilled. That's the first part of being a dispensationalist. The second part of being a dispensationalist is this. We believe that the plan of God, or the reason for God's plan in human history and in the creation of the world, is to bring glory to himself, not simply through saving as many people as possible, but rather to bring glory to himself in a multiplicity of ways. And the upshot of that is that God, even though God certainly does save people, God may use one group of people in one way to bring glory to himself and use a different group of people in a different way to bring glory to himself. And as a matter of fact, we think that's exactly what has happened, and it brings us now to the nub of the third characteristic of dispensationalism, and that is this, that there is a difference between Israel and the church. Israel was called out from all the nations of the world to be the nation or the people of God. That's what happened in the Old Testament. And by the way, Israel is someday going to receive that position in full measure. They will be the world's superpower ruled over by the Lord Jesus Christ, and through Israel, the Lord Jesus will rule all of the Gentile nations. But along the way, God has instituted the church, and the church is also a people of God. Now that leads to all kinds of questions. How can Israel be the people of God and the church be the people of God? Does the church somehow replace Israel, or does Israel somehow get absorbed into the church? What's going on here? And it's going to take me two nights to answer that question. I want to make a preliminary answer tonight using a very vivid word picture that we find in John chapter 10. And then tomorrow night, I want to come at it from a different angle, a little more historically, reviewing the history of Israel, reviewing what God has done in the church, and putting all that together. Can I use the word theologically in this congregation? You won't get intimidated if I talk about theology, will you? We're going to put it together in a way that makes sense. Okay. Now, what we say tonight will make sense too, but tonight is kind of introductory to tomorrow night. And tomorrow night, we're really going to get to this question. If a people is a race, if a people, a biblical people, is a people group or a race, then it makes sense to talk about Israel being a people, right? Because Israel is an ethnic group. But how does it make sense to talk about the church as a people? How is the church a race? That's what we're going to answer tomorrow night. But to get there, I need to lay some groundwork. Maybe I should say, by the way, that the messages this week aren't the kind of messages that you're going to go home saying, wow, that really changed my life. And the purpose of these messages is not to change your life all in one fell swoop. The purpose of these messages is to lay down a foundation. You know, when you lay a foundation, the first time I helped lay a foundation, I was about 10 years old. And my dad was laying a foundation, concrete block foundation, and I went out and helped him. I learned to mix the mortar. I watched how he leveled up the courses of block. I watched how he applied the mortar. I learned how to lay block by watching my dad and by helping him. When you lay a foundation, you don't lay it in vertical sections as a rule. There are a few occasions when you might do that. But you don't lay it in vertical sections. You will lay one course, and then you'll lay another course on top of that, and then another course on top of that. Maybe you'll lay this course on out, and you'll start in on another course or two, and you'll be working on them at the same time. But one is always going to come first. The other one's going to be on top of that. What we're doing in these discussions, in these messages on these evenings, we're laying down some foundations that will give you a solid basis for making life-changing decisions later on. That's the way Bible truth works. Bible truth isn't about getting all, sometimes it is about getting excited, but it's not just about getting all excited in a moment and making a quick decision and never being able to follow through because you don't see all the connections. What we're trying to do here is to provide you with the connections. And tonight, we're going to talk about the relationship between Israel and the church. And this is really important. This has implications all over the place. For example, some of the most important lessons that we learn about church unity come from understanding the difference between Israel and the church. Some of the most important lessons that we learn about Christian living come from understanding the difference between Israel and the church. And to get to this, I want to go to a passage in which Jesus never actually mentions the church by name. But the church is in view before it's ever begun. The passage that we're going to be dealing with is John chapter 10. And we're going to deal mainly with the opening verses of John chapter 10. We will go down and deal with some of the middle verses of the chapter. The beginning of John chapter 10 is a parable, one of very few parables that you find in John's gospel. Lots of parables in Matthew, Mark, Luke, very few parables in John. And this is a parable that's going to take some unpacking, and before we can unpack it, we have to go back and pick up the story in John 9, and you'll see why that is when we get to John 10. So, our goal is to talk about the relationship between Israel and the church. To do that, we need to unpack the parable in John 10. But to do that, we need to go back into John 9. So let's pay attention to the story in John 9. John 9, and I'm not going to read the whole chapter for you. If you'd like, while you listen to me, just allow your eyes to run down the chapter, and I'll highlight certain aspects of the story here. John 9 is the story of the man who was born blind. Jesus and his disciples are walking along, and they see this man who has been blind since his birth. And the disciples ask what they evidently thought was an astute theological question. Master, who was born blind? Was it this man or was it, or who sinned? Was it this man or his parents that caused this man to be born blind? The disciples were assuming that calamity is always the consequence of sin. If you see somebody suffering, that means they sinned somewhere along the line. Jesus' reply ought to banish that way of thinking. Why? Why did New Orleans get hit with a hurricane? Was it because New Orleans was such a terribly sinful city? If it was, then why did the Iowa farmers get all that flooding? Is it because they were such terribly evil farmers? See, Jesus' reply teaches us that there isn't necessarily a connection between calamity and sin. What Jesus says is, no, it wasn't this man who sinned. It wasn't his parents who sinned. Jesus says, but that the works of God should be made manifest in him. In other words, what Jesus is saying is, God wants to do something, and for God to do what he needs to do, there has to be a blind man here right now. And so God, from eternity past, has been planning on this man being born blind so that he could be right here in this spot today. I'm going to demonstrate something to you, Jesus is saying. And I've got to have a blind man to do it. And what follows is a really strange episode. Jesus spits on the ground, and he mixes up some clay, and he takes this clay and he applies it to the eyes of the blind man, and he says to the blind man, go and wash in the pool of Siloam. So the man went to the pool of Siloam, and he washed the clay off his eyes, and he could see. And when he could see, he came back again. Now, as we go on through the story, there's one thing you need to keep in mind. This man has never seen Jesus. He was blind when Jesus was there, heard Jesus speaking very briefly, but he never saw him. This man would not be able to identify Jesus in a police lineup. Okay? Has no idea what Jesus looks like. Now, that's going to become important a little later on. So now the man comes back, and he can see. And we go through a series of episodes in which this guy gets questioned. First, you find the interchange with the neighbors. The neighbors, therefore, verse 8, the neighbors, therefore, and they which before had seen him that was blind, said, is this not he that sat and begged? And there's real puzzlement here. Some said, yeah, it's him. Others said, looks like him. But he said, no, I'm the guy. Now, I'm giving you Bowder's paraphrase as we go along here, okay? So they said to him, how are your eyes open? How can you see? And he answered and said, a man that is called Jesus made clay, put it on my eyes, told me to go and wash in the pool of Siloam. I went and washed, and I can see. So they said unto him, where is he? Where's Jesus? And the guy says, got no clue. You realize, Jesus could have been standing right beside him, and he'd still have made that answer. Maybe Jesus was standing right beside him, and he still made that answer. He has no idea what Jesus looks like. So they brought him to the Pharisees. The neighbors, they hear this story, and they all say, okay, this is above our pay grade. We don't know how to deal with this. We had better get some theological experts in here to deal with this situation. So they bring him to the Pharisees. And verse 14 tells us that it was the Sabbath day when Jesus made the clay and opened his eyes. By the way, have you ever asked yourself, why did Jesus go through all of this process to restore the man's sight? I mean, there are times when Jesus healed by touching a person and just the problem went away. There are times when Jesus healed by simply speaking a word and the problem just went away. There are times when Jesus even healed from a distance. There are people who approach Jesus, more than one in the Gospels, and who say to him, look, we understand authority, you've got authority, all you need to do is to issue the command and the problem will be taken care of even miles away, and Jesus does it. And yet here, he goes through all, can I use the word rigmarole? Goes through all of this rigmarole. I mean, he spits on the ground, he picks up some of the mud, he mixes up some clay, he puts it on the man's eyes, he says, okay, go wash that off now. Why go through all those steps? Well, I think we get the answer to that question in verse 14. And it was the Sabbath day when Jesus made the clay and opened his eyes. You remember, under the rabbinic interpretation of Jewish law, there were a lot of things that were forbidden on the Sabbath day. And one of the things that was strictly forbidden on the Sabbath day was to heal on the Sabbath day. And healing was understood in terms of using medicines and applying poultices and compresses and that kind of thing. Now, before this, There have been plenty of times when Jesus has healed on the Sabbath day with a touch, with a word, something like that. And the Pharisees are really, really irritated with him every time he does that. But it's tough to pin it on him because all he's doing is, you know, speaking a word or something like that. No rules against saying words on the Sabbath day. But here, Jesus deliberately goes through a process that he knows is going to violate what the rabbis say you can do on the Sabbath day. Now, if you're asking, why is Jesus doing this? I can give you a real short answer to that. Because he wanted to annoy the Pharisees. In fact, he wanted to do more than annoy them. As Jesus' ministry progresses, when he starts out, people don't really know who he is, and everybody's coming around to listen to him, and they want to find out more about him. But the more he asserts about himself, and the more he begins to rebuke the legalism of the Pharisees, the more opposition he begins to get. And in this passage, we've kind of reached a tipping point. And Jesus is now determining that he's going to begin pushing the Pharisees into a corner. He is going to force them either to get behind him or just to get opposed to him. They are either going to be his friends or his enemies. And of course, he knows which way they're going to go on that. And it's necessary for him to make them choose sides, because eventually these are the people who are going to crucify him. This is a major step forward now in Jesus challenging the Pharisees. And he deliberately chooses a method of healing that he knows is going to provoke the Pharisees because it's a violation of what they say the Sabbath day is all about. Now, of course, Jesus makes it clear this is no violation of the Sabbath day at all. It's not wrong to do good on the Sabbath. But it's a violation of the rabbi's interpretation. So it's on the Sabbath day. So they bring the man to the Pharisees. And the Pharisees, in verse 15, asked him how he received his sight. And he gives a description. He put clay on my eyes, I washed, I see. You notice the description's getting a little shorter as this guy goes. I think he's beginning to get a little impatient. Therefore, some of the Pharisees said, this man's not of God. Speaking of Jesus, this man's not of God. He doesn't keep the Sabbath day. Others said, how can a man who's a sinner do such miracles? And there was a division among them. The Pharisees are now fighting among themselves. So they turn to the blind man again, and they say, what do you say of him that opened your eyes? Now understand, this blind man has only had the briefest of conversations with Jesus. He heard Jesus and his disciples walk by. He heard the disciples ask this boneheaded question, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? He heard Jesus give the reply, and then all of a sudden, Jesus was putting this mud on his eyes and telling him to go wash it off. And now they're asking him, who is this guy? He's probably making some educated guesses at this point. And the best guess that he can make is, he's a prophet. By the way, that's not a bad answer. Was Jesus a prophet? Absolutely, Jesus was a prophet. Remember, the function of a prophet is to represent God before humans. Absolutely, Jesus was a prophet. That is one of his three offices. He is a prophet like unto Moses. He's not just a prophet. He is the prophet par excellence. So this is not a false answer. It's not a bad answer. But it is an incomplete answer. And this man is going to be forced to kind of work that out a little bit. He'll be forced to flesh out his opinions as we go along here. But the Jews did not believe concerning him. All right, let me explain something right here. In John's gospel, when you come across that expression, the Jews, and it's used in a bad sense, it's not talking about Jewish people as an ethnic block. What it's talking about is the Jewish leadership. So when John says the Jews did this or the Jews did that, he's talking either about the Pharisees or about the Sadducees or about both of them together. So this is not a statement about the nation of Israel. This is a statement about the Jewish leadership. The Jews did not believe concerning him in verse 18 that he had been blind and received his sight until they called the parents of him that had received his sight. So we've gone from the neighbors to the Pharisees. Now we're going to have the parents. So they asked the parents, saying, two questions. Number one, is this your son who you say was born blind? Notice how they put that. They are looking for any way out of this here. Is this your son who you say was born blind? Question number two, how then does he see? And his parents answered and said, we know that this is our son and that he was born blind. For that we will vouch. But by what means he now sees, we don't have a clue. Or who has opened his eyes? We have no idea. He's old enough. Ask him. He'll speak for himself. What the parents are doing here is preparing breakfast food. Waffles, as a matter of fact. This is a grand waffle. They are looking for a way to duck the question. How does he see? His parents are saying, hey, don't talk to us. We're not the experts here. He's old enough. He can answer for himself. Ask him. Why would they make such a strange reply? If this were your son, and he were born blind, and you had had to care for him all his life, and all of a sudden he could see, don't you think you would be a little excited about that? Don't you think you would be a little grateful? I have a daughter who has scoliosis, curvature of the spine. And this curvature of the spine was discovered when she was in fifth grade. And we were at a stage in our lives where we literally had no money to pay for treatment. And at that point, there were a group of people who stepped in and they said, we believe in helping children with this disability. It will cost you nothing. We want to treat her. I'm grateful to those people. To this day, I am grateful to those people. I would think that these parents would have been grateful that their son could see. So why are they waffling on this question? Well, verse 22 tells us, these words spake his parents because they feared the Jews, the Jewish leadership. For the Jews had agreed already that if any man did confess that Jesus was Christ, he should be put out of the synagogue. There's the rub. The Jewish leadership had already determined that if anybody lined up behind Jesus and said he was the Christ, that person was going to get put out of the synagogue. Now you're thinking, big deal, so you're put out of the synagogue. You know, why is that so awful? Well, you've got to understand what this meant to a first century Jewish person. When you were a first century Jewish person, you didn't just go to synagogue for Shabbat. You didn't just go hear the scriptures and the teaching on Saturday. The synagogue was the hub of your life. Now, true, there was a temple in Jerusalem, and all of the official worship was conducted in Jerusalem. And if you could, it was your duty to go to Jerusalem and take your sacrifice and appear at the temple in Jerusalem. But when it came to the day-by-day life of rural Jewish people, the synagogue was what it was all about. It wasn't just a place of worship. It was the place you came every day to get the community news. It was the place where you met your friends and you interacted with them. It was the place where you struck bargains for business deals and you made business transactions. The synagogue was the hub of life for a Jewish person. And if you were cast out of the synagogue, this wasn't just a religious discipline. You didn't just go down the street to the next synagogue and say, here I am, I'd like to join up. There was no doing that. If you were cast out of the synagogue, what this meant was that your life as an Israelite was over. To be cast out of the synagogue was the very same thing as to be cast out of the nation. Remember, the Jews are under the Romans here. They aren't allowed to stone anybody anymore. The worst thing they can do is to cast you out of the synagogue, which means that in their reckoning, you are now dead. To be cast out of the synagogue It's kind of like having to attend your own funeral and hear what people have to say about you, and none of it's good. It was the worst thing that could happen to a Jewish person in the first century. And this man's parents were terrified because word had got out that if anybody endorsed Jesus, the Jewish leadership was going to cast them out of the synagogue. You were further ahead to die than to be cast out of the synagogue. No wonder they were afraid. No wonder they waffled. So they called in the man again. They said unto him, "Give God the praise. We know that this man, Jesus, is a sinner." In other words, change your story. Okay, we can't argue with the fact that you've been cured of your blindness, but just say it was God who did it. Stop giving the credit to Jesus. Jesus is a sinner. The guy's obviously thinking as he goes along here. He considers this. He answered and said, "Whether he be a sinner or no, I know not. One thing I know, that whereas I was blind, now I see." This is not the answer that the Pharisees were hoping for. And it moves them right back to square one. They were hoping that they could deflect the whole issue, get rid of the discussion about Jesus. But the guy's saying, "No, wait a minute. The guy opened my eyes. I was blind, I can see." "All right," they say. "What did he do to you? How did he open your eyes?" Verse 28. This guy's had enough. Okay, they're badgering him. They've badgered his parents. He's about to get serious with them here. He answered them, "I've told you already and you wouldn't listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Would you also like to be his disciples?" Now, may I suggest, this answer was not calculated to win friends and influence people. This guy is beginning to get in their face. Then they reviled him. What that expression means is that there's a complete change in the conversation. Up to this point, it's been a kind of a civil conversation. When it says that they reviled him, what that means now is that they're not interested in his opinions, they're not interested in his testimony anymore. All they want to do is to abuse him and to insult him. Then they reviled him. And they said, "You're his disciple, but we're Moses' disciples. We know that God spoke unto Moses. As for this fellow, we don't know where he's from." But the man's not done. The man answered and said unto them, "Well, this is a marvelous thing. You don't know where he's from, but he's opened my eyes. Now we know that God doesn't hear sinners, but if any man is a worshiper of God and does his will, that's the one whom God hears. Since the world began, it was not heard that any man opened the eyes of one that was born blind. If this man were not of God, he could do nothing." I think this is what in Texas they call standing up on your hind legs. This fellow's getting plain serious. The Pharisees are forcing him to make a choice. Will he side with Jesus or will he side against Jesus? And the more they back him into a corner, the more he comes out swinging. And you can trace it step by step by step through the conversation. This man has now landed himself firmly on Jesus' side. They answered, verse 34, and said unto him, "You were altogether born in sins, and you're teaching us?" Paraphrase that. Who do you think you are? Then notice these words. And they cast him out. That phrase right there is the pivot of this whole passage. It's the most important thing that is said here. If you don't understand this, you're not going to understand anything else that follows. You remember what it means to be cast out of the synagogue? It's not just that the bouncers show you the door, but you come back tomorrow. It's not just that they revoke your church membership, but that's okay because you can go to the other church down the road. To be cast out of the synagogue means that you are no longer considered to be an Israelite. You're no longer part of the nation. You're no longer under the covenant relationship with God. You no longer receive the blessings. You are now to be shunned and abhorred by everybody who is a true Israelite. It's the worst thing that can happen to you. Now stop and think about it. For this guy, in one day, he receives his sight and he is cast out of the synagogue. It's the best day of his life, and it's the worst day of his life, all at the same time. So now what? Jesus heard that they had cast him out. So Jesus went and found him. By the way, I don't think Jesus had to look very far, because as we get along in the passage, what we discover is that these same people are still all standing around. The conversation has barely finished. Maybe Jesus is just standing over there. Maybe he's at the back of the crowd. Maybe he's three blocks down the street. I don't know. Word of this gets to Jesus. You can imagine the buzz. And immediately Jesus goes and finds him. And apparently there is still a crowd standing around when Jesus finds him. When he had found him, he said unto him, "Do you believe on the Son of God?" And he answered and said, "Who is he?" Okay, now my King James has the word Lord there. Maybe some of your translations have the word Sir. It's the Greek word kurios, and the word kurios can go both ways. It can be a polite greeting for a man. It can also be a recognition of lordship. In some ways, it's like our English word, sir. If I'm meeting you on the street or in church, I may address you as sir, and that's just a politeness. On the other hand, if I'm talking about Sir Lancelot of the Lake, now the word sir has an official connotation, right? The word sir means that Lancelot of the Lake is a knight. That's kind of how kurios functions. And in this context, we're going to find that it's used in both ways. Jesus says to the man, "Do you believe on the Son of God?" And he answers and says, "Who is he, sir, that I might believe on him?" Now, don't let that answer puzzle you. Jesus knows who the man is, but the man does not know who Jesus is. Think of it from the man's point of view. He has just been cast out of the synagogue. The words are probably still ringing in his ears. The crowd is gathered around. He's probably wondering, "What do I do next?" And this guy walks up to him and says, "Do you believe on the Son of God?" "Well, who is he, sir, that I should believe on him?" The man has no idea who he's talking to. And then we get Jesus' reply. "You have both seen him," couldn't have said that 24 hours ago. "You have both seen him, and it is he that talketh with thee." In other words, if I can paraphrase that, "Who is he, sir? Do you believe on the Son of God? Who is he, sir, that I should believe on him? Look at me, man. I'm talking to you." That's the effect of what Jesus is saying here. You want to know who the Son of God is? He's right in front of you. Now, finally, this fella has it all figured out. He gets it. He's 100% there. And he said, "Lord, I believe." And he worshiped him. By the way, if you're a first century Jewish person, who do you worship? God. God and the angels, right? No, God. God and Caesar, right? No, God. God and Baal, right? No, God. If you're a first century Jewish person, there is one God, and he is the only one that you worship. When this man worships Jesus, what do you suppose that means? He recognizes exactly who Jesus is. And remember, he's doing this in front of, well, so to speak, God and everybody, quite literally. He's right out in public. He's worshiping Jesus. He has been forced to make a decision, and he has made it. This man believes on Jesus Christ. And Jesus said, I've come into this world for judgment, in order that they which see not might see. Who do you suppose that's referring to? It's the blind man, right? He didn't see, now he does see. In fact, he didn't see in a couple of different ways, and now he does see in a couple of different ways. Physically he can see, but he has also perceived inwardly and spiritually exactly who Jesus was. He couldn't see 24 hours ago, and he didn't know Jesus 24 hours ago. Now both of those things are true. So Jesus says, I've come into this world to judge, in order that those who don't see might see, and in order that those who see might be made blind. In other words, in order that those who claim to have perception will have their ignorance exposed. And some of the Pharisees which were with him, remember I said there are still people standing around while all of this is taking place. Some of the Pharisees which were with him heard these words and said unto him, are we blind also? You know what? They're getting the message. Jesus said unto them, if you were blind, that is to say, if you really didn't and couldn't understand, you would have no sin. But now you say, we see. You claim that you have spiritual knowledge, and it's exactly your claim that condemns you, because you say you see. Your sin remains. By the way, this is one of the worst places in the Bible for a chapter break. There's an old story. You realize the chapter divisions are not part of the original text of Scripture. They were added hundreds of years later on. There is some speculation that the guy who put them in must have been riding on horseback while he was doing it, and occasionally the horse must have just stepped in a hole, because a chapter break comes at a horrible place. This is one of those instances, because the parable of John 10 is part of the same conversation that we're in the middle of in John chapter 9. And here's what the parable is going to do, okay? As far as the people who are standing around and watching are concerned, they have seen what has happened to this blind man. He has been cast out of the synagogue. He is no longer part of Israel. They're thinking this must be God's judgment on him. What Jesus is going to do is to tell a story that completely redefines all of that. Here it is. Verily, verily, I say unto you, he that entereth not by the door into the sheepfold, but climbeth up some other way, the same as a thief and a robber. But he that entereth in by the door is the shepherd of the sheep. To him the porter openeth, and the sheep hear his voice. And he calleth his own sheep by name, and leadeth them out. And when he putteth forth his own sheep, he goeth before them, and the sheep follow him, and they know his voice. And a stranger will they not follow, but will flee from him, for they know not the voice of strangers. This parable spoke Jesus unto them, but they understood not what things they were which he spake unto them. And maybe we don't either when we first read the parable. But let's unpack it a little bit. It's about a sheepfold. Now, a sheepfold is a pen or an enclosure. I suppose if it's big enough, you could even use the word corral, that sheep can be put into. In fact, it's the kind of enclosure that many shepherds would put their sheep into all at the same time for safekeeping. You could have many flocks of sheep all in the same sheepfold. There was a wall around it. It might be a stone wall. It might be a wall of thorns or thistles. But all of the sheep were in the fold. Jesus says that inside of this fold, there are some sheep that belong to him, and there are other sheep that do not belong to him. So now, what we need to do is to come up with something, some outward, visible entity that includes both sheep that belong to Jesus and sheep that don't belong to Jesus. In other words, obviously, Jesus himself is the shepherd, and the sheep are people. The sheep stand for people. So we need some kind of organization, some kind of visible entity, some kind of institution that includes people who belong to Jesus, they believe on him, and people who don't belong to Jesus, they disbelieve him. Is there anything in the context like that? Nod your heads yes. Of course there is. What is it? It's Israel. Israel is the sheepfold. There are people inside the fold who reject Jesus. The Pharisees would be a very good example of that. In fact, Jesus makes it clear that there are some who get into the fold because they come in the wrong way, and they're thieves and they're robbers. That's not meant to be a compliment to the Pharisees, folks. But there are also people in the fold who do belong to Jesus. Here's the thing about Israel. How do you get reckoned as part of Israel? Answer. You're the son or child, son or daughter, of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. If you're the son or daughter of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, then you're part of Israel. If you're a little Jewish boy, then they circumcise you on the eighth day. That's the mark of your inclusion in the people. But the things that constitute you as an Israelite are all external. They are all visible. None of them really means that you believe on God. None of them really means that you're trusting God for salvation. So within Israel, Old Testament Israel, Gospel Israel, there are believers and there are unbelievers. In other words, there are people who follow Jesus, they are his sheep. There are people who reject Jesus, they are not his sheep. You following so far? Is this making sense? Israel is the fold. Inside the fold are some sheep who are Jesus' sheep, other sheep who are not Jesus' sheep. Now, what Jesus is about to do is to state something in a way that completely redefines the position that this blind man is in. And you will find it in verse 3. Back it up to verse 2. He that enters by the door is the shepherd of the sheep. That's Jesus. In other words, the one who has lawful rights, that's the shepherd of the sheep, that's Jesus. To him the porter opens, and the sheep hear his voice, and he calls his own sheep by name and leads them where? Leads them where? Out. Out. Out of what? Out of the fold, right? What did we say the fold was? Israel. Do you understand what Jesus is saying? He's saying, I have people who are part of Israel. But the day is coming when I am going to speak their names, and as they follow me, I am going to lead them out. Out of what? Out of the fold. Out of Israel. Now, does that have anything to do with the man who was born blind? When he began the day, he was inside Israel, right? At the end of the day, was he still inside Israel? No, he had been cast out. What Jesus is saying is that this isn't a judgment that was imposed by the Pharisees. This is Jesus leading his sheep. This man is one of his sheep. This man is a believer. Jesus is saying to the Pharisees, you didn't cast him out, I led him out. And Jesus is saying this is what he's going to do with all of his followers who are part of Israel. In other words, Jesus is saying there is coming a day when all of my followers from Israel are not going to be reckoned as part of Israel anymore. They're going to be outside the fold. It's at this point that we need to talk about a flock. We've talked about a fold, right? The fold is the visible external enclosure that holds the sheep in because they can't cross the boundaries. What holds a flock together? Now, I know this is Wisconsin. You probably don't see a lot of shepherds leading flocks around Wisconsin. But there are parts of the world where you do see that. If you ever go to Israel, you are going to see shepherds leading flocks. I said this morning that we have a campus in Romania. We regularly see Romanian shepherds out in the fields and the hills leading their flocks. In Romania, the shepherds wear great big cloaks made out of sheepskins, and they look like walking haystacks when they move around. I've even seen shepherds with sheep up in the Rocky Mountains. There are Basques, men from northern Spain and southern France, who will get a little trailer and they'll pull it somewhere way up in the Rockies and they'll set up there for the entire summer. They call that their little home on the range. And they'll take a flock of sheep up into the mountains. How does the shepherd keep his sheep together? Does he have a little wire that goes to each sheep and maybe he gives the sheep a shock if it begins to wander? Does he have a leash on each sheep? There's only one way the sheep stay together. They're following the shepherd. The unity of the flock consists in the shepherd. This is what Jesus is talking about when he says that his sheep know his voice. The shepherd puts forth his own sheep before him, and the sheep follow him, for they know his voice. A stranger will they not follow. They'll flee from a stranger. They don't know the voice of the stranger. Following Jesus is what makes his followers into a flock. And by the way, there are huge lessons here for church unity. People try to come up with church unity in all kinds of ways. Let's start a building program. Let's have a fellowship supper together. And we try to contrive unity with all kinds of programs and agendas as if unity were something that could be manipulated. The unity of the church consists in following the shepherd. You want more unity in the church? Then everybody needs to get closer to Jesus. You realize the closer we draw to Jesus, the closer we draw to one another. That's just the way it works. We can never come up with unity by trying to draw close to each other. That always ends up uniting us around the wrong things. You can't even get unity by trying to unite around the pastor. You only get genuine Christian unity when you unite around Jesus Christ. And here Jesus says, "My sheep hear my voice. They follow me." Look down at verse 16. So far, what Jesus has said is really strong language. But what he's going to do in verse 16 is completely unbelievable. This is something that nobody could have seen coming. There was no way to predict what Jesus is going to do in verse 16. It is so radical that at the time it had to be absolutely earth-shattering. Okay, Jesus has said, there's this fold, Israel. Inside that fold, I've got some sheep, my flock. I'm going to speak to my flock. They're going to hear my voice. I'm going to lead them out of Israel. So outside of Israel are going to be these sheep of Jesus who used to be Israelites. Now, look at verse 16. And other sheep I have, says Jesus, which are not of this fold. Who would those be? If the fold is Israel, and the sheep that were inside the fold are Jewish Christians, who would the sheep who are outside the fold be? It's Gentiles, right? That's most of us in this room. Maybe all of us in this room. It's Gentiles. He says, I have other sheep who are not of this fold. Them also I must bring, and they shall hear my voice. And there shall be one. Let me pause right here. I know we're running a little late this evening, but have you got time for a quick Greek lesson? Okay, get this real quick. The word, the Greek word for fold is the word aule, A-U-L-E, aule. The Greek word for flock is the word poimne, poimne, P-O-I-M-N-E. And it's related, actually, to poimen, which means shepherd or pastor. So a poimen is a shepherd, a poimne is a flock. Now, there's no textual division, no textual discrepancy here. All of the Greek manuscripts agree at this point. Let me just give you a Greek word here. Verse 16, other sheep I have, which are not of this aule, them also I must bring, and they shall hear my voice, and there shall be one. Have you ever asked yourself the question? Okay, here are these sheep that used to be in the fold, and now we've got these sheep who were never part of the fold, Jewish believers here, Gentile believers here. Does Jesus intend to have two flocks? How is Jesus going to treat these two different groups of people? Well, that's what this verse is intended to tell us. Jesus says, other sheep I have, which are not of this aule, them also I must bring, and they shall hear my voice, and there shall be one poimne, and one poimen, one fold, and one shepherd. This is the thing that no Jewish person could ever have foreseen, that Jesus would take his sheep and lead them out of Israel, and then he would take his Gentile sheep and he would bring them together into one unified flock. That flock is the church of Jesus Christ. The flock is not the fold. The church is not Israel. There are people in the church who used to be in Israel. They have been let out. There are people in the church who were never part of Israel. They have been made part of the fold. And there are not two folds or two flocks. There's not a Jewish flock and a Gentile flock. There's one flock with one shepherd. So somehow, former Israelites and former Gentiles are united in something that never existed before the time of Jesus. And whatever thing that is, we'll call it the church. It is not Israel. Now that gives us the foundation for saying how it is that the church can be a race. But I've got to show you how that works tomorrow night. And I'll give you a word of apology here. I've gone about 6 or 7 minutes longer than I should have. Thank you for bearing with me and listening carefully. But this is so important. Israel is still the fold. God is not done with Israel yet. God has a future for Israel. But right now, we are the flock. And in the flock, there are people who used to be in Israel, and there are people who used to be Gentiles. But while we are in the flock, we are neither Jewish nor Gentile. We are something else. And what that something else is what we get after tomorrow night.